high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel. Maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are black gold.
How to manifest like you really mean it. There is scientific proof that envisioning your goals can help you achieve them, but that's just step one. And this article is by Eleni Gage. You don't have to make vision boards to know that manifesting or putting your heart's desire out into the universe to will them into being is a major phenomenon. When she performed at the Glastonbury Music Festival, Dua Lipa told the crowd that she had manifested her appearance on the pyramid stage, writing down details such as the fact that she'd appear on Friday so she could party for the rest of the weekend. As an aspiring actor, Jim Carrey famously wrote himself a $10 million check for acting services rendered and carried it with him everywhere. Several blockbusters later, and ka-ching. But for every person with a mind-blowing manifestation story, there's another whose dreams haven't come true or might even verge on delusional. The friend who thinks her trifling boyfriend will finally change his ways. The guy who won't look for a job despite mounting debt because he's sure this is the year his band or acting career or podcast will finally take off. It's enough to make even the most mystical person yearn for some empirical truths. A scientific answer to the question, does manifestation work? We went straight to some scientists who have researched the topic. The verdict is, it's complicated. What is manifestation? We define manifestation as the belief that if you visualize positive things, the universe or a higher power hears those affirmations and then has a part in blessing you with those things, explains Lucas Dixon, PhD, of the University of Queensland in Australia, who conducts research in self-help and how it influences our beliefs and actions. That's right. Despite the woo factor, the concept has been studied scientifically. Studies have shown, for example, that people who exhibit dispositional optimism, who have a more positive than pessimistic point of view, are generally happier than the Debbie Downers among us. And of course, if you believe that you can achieve your goals, it's just generally good for motivation, Dixon says. If you don't believe that you can achieve your goals, you're unlikely to put in the effort to try to start them. Visualization specifically has been studied in the context of athletes visualizing themselves winning, a technique Simone Biles, winner of 11 Olympic medals, swears by. But Dixon argues that extrapolating those findings for the average person is a stretch. With athletes, you have very controlled environments where everyone has a very high standard, similar to each other's. So any little advantage you can get over your peers can be advantageous, he says. In other words, Steph Curry picturing himself shooting a three-pointer with a move he's made countless times may trigger brain activity and muscle memory that actually makes his next shot better. That doesn't mean that simply visualizing yourself accepting a promotion or meeting a new life partner is going to unlock that opportunity for you. Another limit of manifestation. In a series of three studies with results published in 2023, Dixon and his colleagues assessed where over 1,000 participants fell on the manifestation scale. Whether they believed in the ability to cosmically attract success in life through positive talk, visualization, and symbolic actions. Over a third of the participants endorsed manifestation beliefs, and the studies found that those who scored higher on the scale perceived themselves as more successful, had stronger aspirations for success, and believed they were more likely to achieve future success, which sounds like a win. According to the abstract, that same cohort was also more likely to be drawn to risky investments, have experienced bankruptcy, and to believe they could achieve an unlikely level of success more quickly. We think it's a kind of over-optimism, Dixon says, meaning that if you think you're destined to become wealthy, you might be more likely to see any opportunity that comes your way as a positive sign from the universe, even if it's fraudulent or unlikely. Manifestation, according to these studies, can boost your confidence and mood in the short term, but the optimism that comes from believing you can visualize success into existence with the help of the universe could also put you in harm's way. If all you do is visualize success, believing your own hype may actually put you in harm's way. Moving beyond manifestation to mental contrasting. Gabrielle Odigen, a professor of psychology at New York University and author of Rethinking Positive Thinking, concurs. Our lab has been investigating visualization, and we find that these visions are great for giving us a good mood, for mentally exploring possibilities for the future, she says. But when it comes to actually implementing these possibilities, they can lead to decreasing effort and success. In studies her lab has conducted looking at people enrolled in weight reduction programs, the research showed that the more positively participants fantasized about their success in the program, the fewer pounds they lost 3 months and a year down the line than those who didn't. University graduates who visualized an easy transition to work life ended up getting fewer job offers and earning less than their colleagues. The same inverse relationship applied to students who fantasized about earning good grades or building a romantic relationship with a crush. The problem, Odigen realized, is that we get so good at visualization, we trick ourselves into believing that we've already achieved whatever we're dreaming of. In fact, people's systolic blood pressure goes down when they positively fantasize, demonstrating that they're relaxing psychologically and physically. And once you achieve your dream, even if it's make-believe, you might take your foot off the gas and stop trying. As Odigen puts it, these positive fantasies, they zap our energy. The fix, says Odigen, is to see your dreams as a starting point, not as an end result. Fantasies are important because they are an expression of our needs, of what we don't have, Odigen explains. If you deprive someone of interpersonal relationships, they fantasize positively about getting together with their friends and family. The visualization is important because it gives action the direction. So go forth and manifest, but add another step, mental contrasting. This is imagining the obstacle that may stand in the way of achieving your fantasy so you can identify the behaviors necessary to overcome it. Visualizing a positive future gives me direction, says Odigen. Mentally contrasting it with the obstacle in my way gives me the energy to overcome it because I know I'm not there yet. This exercise can also provide a reality check. I will understand what I can do to overcome an obstacle, but I'll also understand if the obstacle is so formidable that I'm better off investing my energy in other projects, says Odigen. How to combine manifestation and mental contrasting? It sounds like a natural progression. Envision a dream, then imagine what you have to do to overcome it to make a reality. But according to Odigen, only about 10% of people, depending on the study, engage in spontaneous mental contrasting. Most of us simply enjoy living in the daydreams, while some of us ruminate solely on the obstacles in our path. That doesn't work either, warns Odigen. You need to do both in order to build a roadmap to help you get to your desired outcome. Want to try it? Odigen has developed a technique called WOOP, Wish, Outcome, Obstacle, Plan. It's on her website, whoopmylife.org, to help people practice mental contrasting. In short, mental contrasting accounts for the fact that life is a mix of luck and effort, magic and work. As neurosurgeon, neuroscientist, and Stanford adjunct professor James Doty, MD, who outlines his own 6-week program to master manifestation in his book, Mind Magic, writes, "The universe doesn't give a bleep about you. You are the universe, and it is only you who can give a bleep. It's only you who can harness the power within yourself, and that is the real magic." All right, next, how and why to find humor in the darkest moments. And this article is by Chris Duffy. Done poorly, it shrinks grief. Done well, it gives shape to the unthinkable and invites others to hold it with you. In April 2013, I was at the Boston Marathon waiting to watch my roommate run past. I was standing a half a mile from the finish line when the bombings happened. That night, I sheltered in place as we heard sirens in the street and helicopters overhead searching for the bombers. It's the only time I've ever felt brave to be eating an entire pot of spaghetti in my underwear. When terrible things happen in the world, sometimes my job as a comedian feels irrelevant or even inappropriate. How can I go out and tell jokes when there's blood on the ground? Ignoring naked human suffering feels offensive. Trying to make people laugh feels insane. The sheer horror of these kinds of events is almost possible to put into words. But I think one of the most important functions of humor is to communicate what we can't express otherwise. Humor provides a way of dealing with our most powerful emotions and feelings. And the more I think about and live through tragic moments, the more I see that humor can play a crucial role in grief and resilience. If you're looking for a group of people with a great sense of humor, historically one of the best ways to find them is to identify a group that has been oppressed and experienced suffering. When external forces try to crush a people, an irrepressible opposing force of humor and comedy often emerges to allow them to maintain their humanity. From Irish folk having a crake to Jewish borscht belt comedians to the long influential history of black humor in America to the outrageous wit of drag queens, as far as I can tell, it's a universal truth that oppressed groups are funnier than oppressors. In his book, On the Real Side, A History of African American Comedy, Mel Watkins writes about the parallels between black humor and Jewish humor in the United States. The outsider or shadow position of Jews and blacks in mainstream American history has given them a unique perspective of them on themselves as well as on the dominant or majority culture. Both Jewish and black humor may often be self-efficacing, but it's not masochistic. Instead, it's a way for an outsider to deflect and diffuse dangerous anger and prejudice into laughter. This type of humor was often a way to safely express feelings of frustration or rage by masking them as a joke. Watkins shares a legendary story by the comedian Dick Gregory from the 1960s. A black man enters a southern restaurant and is told, "Sorry, we don't serve colored folks here." His reply, "Fine, I don't eat them, just bring me a medium rare hamburger." Racial, ethnic, and racial groups are not alone in using humor to build resilience and cope with suffering. There's a long tradition of gallows humor. Soldiers at war joke about death and the terrible food. Doctors joke about the difficult patients, stress, and sleep deprivation. Grave diggers joke about, I'm assuming, the graves. The point isn't the jokes themselves, but the broader idea. When you're in a moment of intense grief or suffering, it can feel unspeakable. Done poorly, humor can mask or minimize. It can be a defense mechanism to push other people away. But the kind of humor I advocate for in my book, Humor Me, How Laughing More Can Make You Present, Creative, Connected, and Happy, creates connection and serves as a pressure release valve. It shows a way to speak about the unspeakable and even for a moment to laugh about it. To leave you with some parting principles, let's go on the road with Michael Cruz Kane. He's toured the United States with a one-man show about the death of his son called Sorry for Your Loss. It's one of the most expertly crafted pieces of live theater I've ever seen. At many moments, I was laughing hard at a perfect joke, and then minutes later, I'd be sobbing in my seat. Kane has spoken with the audiences after the performances and heard the myriad ways they connect with his story. That combination of cathartic humor and grief is what moves people the most. Kane's advice for how we can put his skills into practice comes in two parts. The jokes that resonate the most about grief for me are the ones that poke fun at all the weird stuff around it. Your uncle got drunk at the funeral. Your stepsister's condolence card had a link to her online jewelry store. There's such a performance of seriousness around grief that people forget how weird they are. Just acknowledging the weirdness is a huge relief. As for the jokes that make it worse, anything that hints at minimizing or delegitimizing, the grief, are we still doing this? Get over it already. Or telling you how to feel, smile, is a big no-no, as far as I'm concerned. And next, for me, humor is easy to find. Notice things, internal and external, and talk about them. That's 80% of it. Among many services it provides, humor is a release of anxiety and tension, a release that comes from sharing the anxiety. I also notice that the rabbi is falling asleep, etc. The spark of recognition that observation sets off in you and your friends is the beginning of humor. To me, that's a perfect idea to end with. Even as we navigate through our darkest moments, we can be looking for a spark of recognition. And please, dear God, do not use your condolence card as an opportunity to drive traffic to your online boutique. And this is from Humor Me, How Laughing More Can Make You Present, Creative, Connected, and Happy by Christopher Duffy. Right next, we've got The Brain-Boosting Power of Walking with Loved Ones. Total game changer. And this article is by Corinne Miller. The brain is your body's command center, so keeping it in working order is really a non-negotiable. While doctors have repeatedly recommended factors like eating well and trying to do activities to support brain health, research over the last few years has shown that two habits worth prioritizing in your daily life are walking and spending time with loved ones. Every walk you take is a step toward a sharper mind in more ways than one. A growing body of research shows that regular walking can boost memory, sharpen focus, and even slow cognitive decline, including reducing risk of developing dementia. Separate research has shown that walking can boost creativity, too. People who were physically active, including with walking at some point within the last 3.5 hours, showed processing speeds equivalent to someone 4 years younger while playing brain games, a study published in the Annals of Behavioral Medicine found. The second game changer for your thinker, socialization. Your brain thrives on this connection, and research backs this up. A separate body of research shows that regular social connection can shore up memory, problem solving, and also reduce dementia risk. Another study, published in the Lancet Healthy Longevity, found that people who interacted with family and friends on a weekly or monthly basis had a slower rate of memory decline than those who socialized less. With that, it's worth exploring whether doing both at once would be a double whammy for your brain health. While this powerhouse combo hasn't technically been studied formally just yet, doctors say there might be something to this health hack. Let's investigate. Why walking with a loved one is a smart combo for brain health. There are a few mechanisms at play. One is the fact that walking is simply a great form of exercise. Anything that improves overall cardiovascular health will help reduce dementia risk, says Jonathan Howard, MD, a neurologist at NYC Health and Hospitals Bellevue. Your brain needs healthy blood vessels to function properly, get nutrients, and remove toxins. And there's an established link between heart disease and dementia. Getting your steps in can help support overall health, and that will do your brain a solid too, says Amit Sachdev, MD, a medical director in the Department of Neurology at Michigan State University. Overall health is important for brain health, he notes. Walking directly boosts brain health too. It triggers the expression of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, a protein that supports nerve cell growth and survival in the brain and spinal cord. BDNF is involved in crucial tasks like memory and learning, says Scott Kaiser, MD, Director of Geriatric Cognitive Health for the Pacific Neuroscience Institute at Providence St. John's Health Center. That helps to create a well-functioning brain network, he says. Walking can also help reduce your overall stress levels. Stress can negatively impact your brain on a cellular level when it goes unchecked. And ramping up your step count can help counteract this, says Dr. Kaiser. Time with loved ones is an anti-stressor, too. You can support good heart health, which, again, ultimately boosts brain health, Dr. Kaiser says. There may be even an indirect link here. If you're feeling well-connected, you may be more likely to make better choices for your health and brain health around drinking, eating, and substance abuse, Dr. Kaiser says. To be clear, there are no available studies that specifically found walking with a loved one can prevent dementia. However, a 28-week group walking program helped people with dementia maintain a steady quality of life over the testing period, and the intervention was well-liked by both participants and their caregivers. There are studies to support the benefits of group exercise, particularly outdoor group exercise, especially when it comes to lowering stress levels. We know that exercising is good and that socializing in groups is beneficial, Dr. Kaiser says. Theoretically, the benefits for brain health could be greater when you do them together. How often to walk with loved ones for optimal brain health? It's hard to put a specific number on this, given that the research hasn't extended into this territory yet. If you want to set a lofty goal, Dr. Howard suggests trying to walk for 30 minutes at a time on most days of the week. Since it can be tricky to consistently block out that time with family and friends, Dr. Kaiser just recommends doing what you can. Most evidence suggests that inactivity is bad, and any amount of activity is a good amount. But in general, more is better. If going for longer walks with loved ones is hard to pull off, Dr. Kaiser recommends trying to squeeze in exercise snacks, like walking out of the office at the end of the night with your work buddy, or taking a lap around the neighborhood with your mom during a visit instead of catching up on the couch. You can also try taking up your own walking habit and socializing by chatting on the phone with loved ones. By the way, you can take up this new habit anytime. I can't think of any age group that won't benefit from this, Dr. Kaiser said. There's a lot that goes into supporting good brain health, but walking with a loved one checks off a lot of boxes and gets in some quality social time, too. It makes sense to kill two birds with one stone, Dr. Howard says. All right, next, why you might want to try the heart-healthy Nordic diet by Michelle Ross. By now, the Mediterranean diet needs no introduction. It's one of the most researched and most reliably praised eating patterns for health and longevity. But there's another way of eating hailing from farther north that's gaining quiet momentum. Meet the Nordic diet, a seasonal, plant-forward way of eating backed by a growing body of research linking it to better heart health and long-term vitality. What is the Nordic diet? Think of it as the Northern European answer to the Mediterranean diet. The Nordic diet is modeled after the traditional foods and eating habits of people living in the Nordic countries, including Denmark, Norway, Iceland, Sweden, and Finland. It was reportedly developed by European chefs, nutrition experts, and scientists in 2004, and in order to reemphasize the benefits of producing and eating regional staples, the menu leans on minimally processed plant foods, fatty fish, and healthy fats, says Michelle Ruthenstein, RD, a preventive cardiology dietitian, and the owner and founder of Entirely Nourished. It's also low in red and processed meats, added sugars, and ultra-processed foods, just like its Mediterranean counterpart. However, the specific foods eaten on the Nordic diet are ones that are traditionally grown and eaten in that region. Per Ruthenstein, these are some heavy hitters: whole grains, fruits, root and cruciferous vegetables, fatty cold water fish such as salmon, herring, and mackerel, fermented dairy, and healthy fats like monounsaturated fats from rapeseed oil, canola oil, and nuts. Beans and lentils are often also part of the Nordic diet, offering plant-based protein and plenty of gut-friendly fiber. There's also a big emphasis on eating seasonally, adds Maddie Pasquarello, RDN. It stresses regionally processed foods, environmental sustainability, and minimizing transportation time between producer and consumer. Think shopping at your farmer's market rather than superstores, or eating berries only when in season or frozen at their peak. Benefits of the Nordic diet. It hasn't been well studied as the Mediterranean diet, but evidence has shown that it suggests boosts health and longevity outcomes. In one of the diet's earliest randomized controlled trials, published in 2010, 88 adults with high cholesterol followed either the Western diet or the Nordic diet, and those on the Nordic diet saw improvements in their cholesterol levels, insulin resistance markers, and blood pressure, as well as a moderate reduction in body weight. This wasn't just a one-time finding either. A 2022 review of studies found that eating a Nordic-style diet is linked to reduced risk of cardiovascular disease and diabetes. The potential perks aren't just for your heart either. One 2023 systematic review also found that the Nordic diet may support neurological function, brain health, and symptoms of depression. A 2025 systematic review and meta-analysis in the European Journal of Nutrition found that people who stuck with it had lower risks of all-cause mortality and reduced risk of death from cancer or cardiovascular causes. The diet was also associated with reduced incidences of type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, coronary heart disease, stroke, and cancer. The plan may be well suited for women in midlife too. It aligns well with their cardiometabolic needs during perimenopause when the cardiovascular risk rises, says Katu Dabkar, MD, MPH, a board certified cardiologist with expertise in preventive cardiology in Charlotte, North Carolina. Why? The fiber from fruits, vegetables, and whole grains might help with insulin sensitivity and weight control as estrogen declines, he says, while fatty fish and plant oils offer omega-3s that can help reduce inflammations and lower triglycerides. Is it any better than the Mediterranean diet? The two plants have a lot in common, says Ruthenstein, namely a plant-forward approach that emphasizes vegetables, fruits, whole grains, and nuts and fish, while limiting red and processed meat. In short, the overarching principles are the same. Each simply takes a more local twist. Think of it as applying Mediterranean principles with northern ingredients. One of the biggest distinctions comes down to fat. The Nordic diet relies on rapeseed oil, whereas the Mediterranean diet is rich in olive oil, though both are good sources of heart-healthy unsaturated fats. Dairy also diverges slightly. Nordic diets favor low-fat dairy and fermented products, while Mediterranean diets allow moderate amounts of full-fat cheese and yogurt. Is it right for me? In a word, probably. I can't think of many people who wouldn't benefit from eating more fruits and vegetables, having protein come from plant sources compared to animal sources, eating more fiber and complex carbs, and eating less saturated fat, says Pascarello. We have thousands of studies who suggest the benefits of doing these things. That stated, it might not suit everyone's taste. Want to dip a toe in? Take cues from a study published in 2024 in the journal Current Developments in Nutrition. In adults who adopted dietary patterns in line with the Nordic Nutrition Recommendations 2023, the highest upticks in life expectancy were linked to consuming more legumes, nuts, and whole grains, as well as less processed meat and added sugar. So even if you're not jazzed about herring, you can eat more rye bread or blueberries. It's a small step in the right direction, and your health will say, we have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Daily. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Tyra Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Oprah Daily is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.
Hold your head as high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel, maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are